This morning, in this first hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking about the international effort to limit the spread of nuclear weapons. This month, governments around the world have sent delegations to the United Nations for a review of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. This is something that happens every 5 years. Most of the states signed the treaty promising not to develop nuclear weapons, and those already having them among the United States promised, this was back in 1970 when the agreement came into effect, they promised that they would move toward disarmament. In this part of Focus, we'll talk a little bit about the treaty, both its past and its future, and our guest for the show is Ambassador Robert Gray. He's director of the Bipartisan Security Group at the Global Security Institute. This is a think tank that was founded by Senator Alan Cranston, who was very concerned about the spread of nuclear weapons. And the focus of the Institute is indeed to promote security through the elimination of nuclear weapons. Let me tell you a little bit more about Ambassador Gray. He's the former U.S. representative to the Conference on Disarmament. He was also leader of the State Department UN reform team. He was a senior fellow on the Council on Foreign Relations, also served as counselor for political affairs of the U.S. mission to the United Nations in New York. He served as acting deputy director of the Arms Control and Disarmament Agency, as well as counselor for political affairs at the U.S. mission to NATO in Brussels. And he is joining us this morning by telephone. As we talk, questions, as always, are welcome. The only thing we ask of people who call in is that they are brief in their comments, and we ask that so that we can get in as many different people as possible and keep the conversation moving. But of course, anyone who is listening is welcome to call. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 is the number. If you should happen to be listening around Illinois and Indiana, it would be a long-distance call. Or if you're listening on the Internet, as long as you're in the United States, you may use the toll-free line, and that is 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Those are the numbers. Ambassador Gray, hello. Are you there, sir?
Hello?
Yes, hello. I think we just didn't have a button push there.
Oh, there you go.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
We certainly appreciate it. Just for a moment, would you like to talk just a little bit more about the Global Security Institute and what it's all about?
Well, yes. Basically, the Global Security Institute is interested in the promotion of arms control and as a vehicle for diplomacy and for national security. And the group I had, the Bipartisan Security Group, is a number of people who've served in arms control-related positions, either in the Central Intelligence Agency, the Department of Defense, or the State Department, or the military, or the old Arms Control Agency. And I think of the eight people in a little group, we probably have collectively about 450 years of experience in arms control-related matters. It's pretty divided between males and females. There's a sprinkling of both. About, I think we have three or four women on our board of about nine of us, and we have a fairly bipartisan representation as well. So we have Republicans and Democrats working together on this.
Hmm. Well, specifically, let's move and talk a little bit about the Non-Proliferation Treaty. I think that if one looks back to the 1960s and the time when this treaty was forged and look at the number of countries that either had nuclear weapons or had nuclear weapons programs, I think at the time the fear was that if something wasn't done, the nuclear club, the number of countries that had these weapons, would continue to grow. And I think some people looking back at that time would say that actually we haven't done too badly on this issue. That is, that there was this expectation that at this point there might be many more countries that have nuclear weapons than actually do. And so some people are saying that we can say that for that reason, that means that the treaty has been a success. Do you think that that is the case?
I think that's the case. The estimation at the time was that if we didn't have the treaty, we'd have maybe 20 to 30 nuclear weapon states today, rather than the 8 and question mark North Korea and that we have today. Mm-hmm. So, yes, on the whole, it's been relatively successful. I think it's enormously successful, actually, when you consider that 188 members of the signatories to the treaty. And I think it has achieved its objective pretty successfully. Hmm.
The other side of this, though, I think it particularly now that this review, this regular review of the treaty is going on, there are people who are voicing a lot of concern about the future of the treaty, or perhaps what concerns them is the kind of commitment, particularly among the nuclear states, and we would be at the top of that list, the commitment to fulfilling the treaty, and it, and where we are concerned, that is the commitment to actually move toward disarmament.
Well, I think there are two elements in the treaty that have to be addressed and are being addressed, hopefully successfully, but so far I'm not optimistic. The first one is that the treaty was a bargain, basically, in which the nuclear weapon states agreed that they would ultimately eliminate their nuclear weapons. And the others agreed that they would have unimpeded access to nuclear technology for peaceful purposes. We have to tighten up the treaty in terms of the non-proliferation objectives to make it more rigorous. Because as it stands now, a state could practically get to the verge of going nuclear under the treaty, fulfilling its obligations, and then suddenly go quickly into a nuclear weapon status. We need to tighten up the transfer provisions for the technology and the inspection provisions of the treaty to tighten it up in the non-proliferation aspect. In return for that, the non-nuclear weapon states expect the United States and the other four nuclear weapon states recognized under the treaty to begin to move more actively towards the ultimate objective of the total elimination of nuclear weapons. And that's the rub. It seems to me that, yes, we have to improve the non-proliferation aspects of the treaty by tightening up the inspection provisions and the technology transfer provisions, but in return for that, we and the other four nuclear weapon states have to make some tangible acknowledgement that we are ultimately committed to the total elimination of the weapons over time. So we get a present commitment on non-proliferation in return for a future commitment for nuclear disarmament. That's the bargain. And so far, at least this administration has been reluctant to reaffirm that obligation in a convincing manner for the others.
Well, that, as you say, that is the complaint that some people have made, and that is that the non-nuclear states, those that weren't, made the promise that they would not become nuclear states, but this hinges on, or the other part of this was for countries, those that had the nuclear weapons, the United States, Britain, France, Russia, and China, to move toward disarmament. And there, that's where there has been a lot of criticism, particularly of the United States and of the Bush administration, for not honoring that part of it.
Well, it's not a question of honoring. It's a question of reaffirming that commitment, because in the 2000 review conference, in which I participated very actively for many nights and many early mornings, we did make an unequivocal commitment to the total elimination of nuclear weapons. We did, and so did the other four nuclear weapon states. At the moment, it appears that this administration is reluctant to even reaffirm that commitment. So it's that's the problem. The other problem is, of course, that suspicions are aroused because this administration is seeking funding for a new generation of nuclear weapons, which implies that there's a useful purpose for them in today's world, which seems problematic to me. They're building an anti-ballistic defense to defend against the possibility of a nuclear attack, and a defense in this context becomes part of your offense. And finally, they are not interested, apparently, in a number of arms control agreements that we've been working on for years, the Biological Weapons Convention, et cetera, et cetera. They're unwilling to negotiate now a fissile material cutoff treaty with inspection provisions. So there's a lot of stuff out there that indicates what I would say is a marked preference for unilateral action and a marked distaste for multilateral cooperation. Mm.
Well, as you say, the last time this review took place, this was in 2000, there was this document produced committing the five nuclear states to take 13. I've seen many references to this. I'm not sure what the steps are, but to take these 13 practical steps toward disarmament. And that was a step beyond a commitment, a less concrete commitment, but a similar kind of commitment that had been made in 1995.
That's right.
We've
been gradually ratcheting up the commitment to the ultimate elimination of nuclear weapons, all five of them. And I must say, it was done with American leadership. We led the debate. We led the discussions with the other nations, and we came up with a compromise that is embodied in those 13 interim steps. Now, obviously, an administration that is against the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty isn't going to endorse it again. You can't expect that. But there are a number of elements in those 13 steps that this administration ought to endorse. So that's the rub.
Let me very quickly introduce again our guest for anybody who might have tuned in. We're speaking with Ambassador Robert Gray. He is director of the Bipartisan Security Group at the Global Security Institute. This is an institute that was founded by Senator Alan Cranston. The major focus of the institute is nuclear disarmament. He is former U.S. representative to the Conference on Disarmament and was also leader of the State Department UN Reform Team. He has been a senior fellow on the Council on Foreign Relations, Counselor for Political Affairs of the U.S. Mission to the U.N. He served as Acting Deputy Director of the Arms Control and Disarmament Agency, as well as Counselor for Political Affairs at the U.S. Mission to NATO in Brussels, and has been interested in working on this particular issue, that is nuclear weapons, for quite a long time. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Do you believe that in the U.S. defense structure, there is any place for nuclear weapons?
I believe that for the foreseeable future, and we're talking out 20 years or so, I think for a deterrence to deter a possible attack on the United States, we need a limited number of nuclear weapons. We can do with far, far fewer than we have now. But the ultimate goal has to be to try to achieve in the future, and we're talking about 20, 30 years perhaps, a kind of international stability in which we can move towards the ultimate elimination of these weapons. That's pretty hard to imagine for some people, but I do think it's a possibility, but clearly, a world in which there's a couple of hundred of these things lying around instead of several, you know, thousands and thousands as we have now, it would be a much more stable world and a world in which our security would be materially enhanced.
Well, given the fact that many of the nuclear weapons that we have are old and people raise questions about their stability, their functionality, what do you think of the idea of doing some kind of redesign to produce newer weapons? Maybe we could cut down on the overall number, but something to address the issue of the aging existing weapons.
Well, we have the existing weapons are not aging in the sense that they're not going to work if we have to use them. We have a huge program. We spend hundreds of millions of dollars every year checking to the continued viability of these weapons. We have a huge program that does that. So it's not a question of them aging or becoming obsolete. But if you're redesigning these things, the implication is that you're going to use them in an emergency situation. For deterrence purposes, the systems we have now are perfectly adequate. When you go beyond deterrence and begin to consider a warfighting capability, the implication is that we're not serious about ultimately getting rid of them. And I think the time has come, long since come, when we should stop testing weapons, have a total ban on testing weapons, and begin to move in the direction we said we were going back in the 70s.
Do you have concerns about the administration's commitment to the Nuclear Test Ban Treaty?
The administration has suggested that it is not planning to test. I think we have to take them at their word. I know American government makes a commitment to publicly like that if they don't mean it. But if you create a fast-track capability to begin to test if an emergency takes place, you're saying a couple of things. You're saying, well, we may change our mind. And the other thing is we may want to create new weapons for new purposes. And it seems to me that in an era when we have the most powerful military worldwide, we have an overwhelming military superiority in all levels and in all things, that we should be seeking a world where we have less reliance on nuclear weapons and others have less reliance on nuclear weapons. It seems to me that as we progress and we get into electronic and the sophisticated sorts of conventional things we have today, that it's manifestly in our interest to get rid of these things, because in a funny way, the nuclear weapon becomes the weapon of the poor or the weak. A North Korea without nuclear weapons is a pushover. A North Korea with nuclear weapons is a menace to its neighbors. So I think that the total thrust should be a world in which the risk of nuclear war is diminished, and that in turn strengthens our security enormously.
During the Cold War, the two states that had the largest number of nuclear weapons were Russia and the United States, and I'm assuming that of the nuclear countries today, that is still the case?
Yes. We number our inventories in thousands. I think the other nuclear weapon states would have to be in the low hundreds.
Mm-hmm. There has been, since the end of the Cold War, a cooperative effort involving the United States and Russia for the United States to try to assist Russia in dismantling weapons and securing the material, the bomb material.
Right.
How successful has that been?
It's been relatively successful, but I have to, in all candor, say that it's never been fully funded from our side. Hmm. And there have been glitches on the Russian side about, you know, being more forthcoming in terms of speeding it up. But the reality is that it's never been fully funded. And if we're looking at a real risk for nuclear proliferation, it's all that stuff that's sitting over there oozing into the ground in Russia. We ought to round it up, get it cleaned up, and get it the heck out of there. So that's something that really is a priority, an urgent priority, and it's never been fully funded. For the life of me, I can't see why we're building a ballistic missile defense that costs billions of dollars when the most immediate threat is that the loose nukes in Russia.
Specifically, to talk about the problem of the global stockpile of nuclear material, that is, the kinds of stuff that you would use to make a nuclear weapon, that seems to be one of the great focuses when you talk about the problem of terrorism and the fact that this material might fall into the hands of terrorists. How much of this material is there? Where is it? And is security something that we need to be worried about?
Well, I think in the long run, it's a real risk. I wouldn't even venture the numbers because you could make a guesstimate on it, and people do. But I don't think even the Russians know how much stuff they have lying around. Hmm. It's a lot, hundreds of tons, hundreds thousands of tons perhaps that could be used to develop a weapon, or for that matter, just to be strewn around the landscape and posing risks with radioactivity and stuff. But there's a lot of it. It's mostly in the Soviet Union. The sooner we round it up and blend it down and turn it into something that can't be reconverted into nuclear weapons, the safer we'll all be. Now, it seems to me that once someone gets the material, there's enough scientific knowledge out there anywhere that they could very rapidly fabricate a weapon if they wish to do so. Mm-hmm. So the risk is the material itself getting into the wrong hands. Probably more difficult for a group of terrorists to do it than a rogue state like say North Korea or Iran or whatever, but still there's a risk there. I think getting it in the hands of terrorists, if they get a weapon, obviously it's going to be tragic. But fabricating one, I think, is a challenge for them, but not for a country that gets the material and has the scientists.
Mm-hmm. Well, that, I guess, was one of the questions that I had. Obviously, this material, radioactive material, would be dangerous, and it would be the kind of thing that one could use to make what has been called the dirty bomb. So you could use a conventional explosive and use that to disperse the radioactive material and cause a large area of terror, no doubt make a lot of people sick, perhaps kill them, cause a large area of territory to be uninhabitable for a while. So that wouldn't take a great deal of technical expertise. I guess the question that I have is just how much expertise and what sort of technology would you have if you were going to then take that material and make a nuclear weapon out of it. I would think that that would
That's a pretty tricky problem.
Difficult. It would be not. It's not something that could easily be done.
It's not something that could be easily done. It could be done, but it's you know, you think of the assembling the kind of scientific knowledge that's there. In other words, the people and the processing plants and all of that. That's a pretty tough proposition for any group. I think that probably would be detected at some point in time. But the dirty stuff, that's a totally different problem.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds as if perhaps the greater concern as far as terrorism is concerned is that a terrorist would manage to acquire a nuclear weapon, something that already existed, a functional nuclear weapon.
No, I mean, you know, they've got artillery shells that have nuclear payloads. No, that's a real risk, and that's why I would, for one, be much more enthusiastic about an administration that's fully funding and working hard at getting rid of this loose material over there than I would in expending money on other things that we're deploying a ballistic missile system that doesn't work and we're spending billions of dollars on it. That strikes me as the least worrisome threat we have is somebody throwing a nuclear rocket at us. Mm.
We have a caller here that I want to bring into the conversation.
Sure.
Why don't we do that? Someone who is here on our toll-free line number 4, right here. Hello.
Yes. The first question, if I read history properly, the Germans were working on atomic weapons during World War II, as was the U.S. Now, I'm going to ask or put this as a scenario. What would have happened if had the Germans perfected it and used it, and where would they have used it?
Well, Ambassador, is that something you feel like that you can answer?
Gee, I can't. I don't know where. I just saw this movie about Hitler in the last days with the Swiss actor, and I don't know how anyone could predict what that fellow would have done. I would assume that given the delivery systems available at the time, that he would have probably used it somewhere against a European target rather than directly at the United States, because I don't think they had the capability to project anything our way unless they loaded it up on a submarine or something. So probably, if they had such a thing, they would have probably used it in the European theater, but that's just speculation on my part.
Well, then the second thing is, the conversation so far has pointed at their existence. And in my opinion, I think it is too late. The genie is out of the bottle, and there's absolutely no way to put it back in. So long as we persist in dealing with the world's population, the U.S., who now brags that they are the world's only superpower with atomic weapons and a history of using them, even as late as in the Balkan War, the shells with depleted uranium, which, if I understand right, has created some problems for humans there, let alone being hit by the bullets, but with that stuff, you know, spread around on the ground and among populations. There is absolutely no way. I mean, this problem is not going to go away until the arrogance is abated and we begin to do something about the crimes that the U.S. has committed against the world since World War II and continues to do so, and with a cowboy attitude that now persists, that we're the biggest gun in town and we do not have to say yes to anything or anybody. And what do you think of that?
Well, I think we're not the only country in the world that occasionally has cowboy instincts. I would say that, yes, I can. At the end of the Cold War, I can see every reason why it's in our interest to diminish our reliance and other people's reliance on nuclear weapons. I think that's very important. I think, as my old headmaster used to say, it's not what you say, it's how you say it, it's not what you do and how you do it. And I think we should be setting an example in all humility to accept our responsibilities as world leader and to forge coalitions which reduce the risk of nuclear war rather than posturing and suggesting that there's some validity to it, or that it makes any sense in terms of our own national interest to retain these weapons. Now, on the depleted uranium thing, when I was in government, and I don't think that's changed, it's the weight of the depleted uranium that enables it to penetrate heavy armor and destroy a tank, say. But I would not subscribe to the theory that this stuff itself causes radioactive sickness or anything like that. I think that's, frankly, a rather extreme position, and it's not proven. So I would just demur on that. But I think it's a question of our attitude and our posture. And we led the world in creating the United Nations and a series of alliances for peaceful coexistence, all of that stuff, and we should be leading now. And what I'm concerned about is that we're not. We should be leading the way to forge international coalitions to reduce the risk to mankind, not renouncing environmental treaties, renouncing all kinds of other treaties, being very suspicious about international cooperation in any form. I spent my life negotiating to make it a safer world. I think negotiations help. It's not the whole answer, but it's certainly one of the tools in our toolkit and one that we should be using more vigorously than we are.
Hmm. Let me ask you this, and perhaps this is it's a difficult question, but the ultimate, for a lot of people, the ultimate goal would be to see the complete elimination of nuclear weapons, admittedly something that is very difficult and might never happen, but it's something that we work toward. Given the fact, though, that the expertise, the technical knowledge would always exist, and that the nuclear material would be there and it would be possible to make it into something that you could make into a bomb, what do you think about the real possibility that some point we could actually achieve complete nuclear disarmament? That is, we could get rid of all nuclear weapons everywhere.
It's a question I've asked myself repeatedly over the years. All I can say is that when the day comes, and if you're the director of the CIA or whatever, or in Negroponte's job, the new job, and the President of the United States calls you in and said, well, here we are. What do you think? Can we get rid of them all? I don't know. I can't imagine in my lifetime I would be ever in a position to say, yes, we can do that with absolute certainty, unless we have in place arrangements or something. Maybe we can take the last 50 and lock them up somewhere where a committee has to take them out of the international community. I don't know. But all I can say is I'd love to be in the position when someone could ask me that question. And we're not there yet by a long shot. I think it's a goal. I think it's something we should try to do. And what we have to do is make sure as we reduce these numbers that we do it transparently, that when we take this stuff out of the inventory, it disappears. The weapon is dismantled. The material is altered so it can't be used. And we blend it down. We set up inspection regimes and build the kind of confidence where we can approach that goal. And, you know, the deal we have with the Russians now, this so-called Moscow Treaty, this doesn't eliminate the weapons. It just puts them in a storeroom. You know, it's not totally verifiable. It's not irrevocable. It's just it's an intent to make a contract, but it's not a contract. And it's certainly nothing that's very reassuring to the rest of the world that wants to see this stuff disappear, not go into a storeroom.
We have a couple of callers here we'll get to in just a moment, and I do want to introduce again our guest, Ambassador Robert Gray. He's been working in the area of arms control for some time. He is currently director of the Bipartisan Security Group at the Global Security Institute. The institute was founded by Senator Alan Cranston, who was very concerned about the spread of nuclear weapons, and the focus of the institute is indeed to promote security through the elimination of nuclear weapons. Ambassador Gray is former U.S. representative to the Conference on Disarmament. He was also leader of State Department UN reform team. He has been senior fellow on the Council on Foreign Relations, counselor for political affairs of the U.S. mission to the United Nations. He's also served as acting deputy director of the Arms Control and Disarmament Agency and also as counselor for political affairs at the U.S. mission to NATO in Brussels. And we're talking here this morning about nuclear proliferation and specifically the non-proliferation treaty right now in New York City all this month. There are meetings going on at the United Nations. Delegations from all over the world are there for the regular review of the NPT. It's something that happens every 5 years. Questions are welcome. We just ask people to be brief so we can keep things moving, but anyone's welcome into the conversation. 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. The next callers we have are here locally, and we'll go first to someone in Savoy. That's line one. Hello.
Hi there. How you doing?
Good.
Hey, we worked on a project. I don't know. It's been 7-8 years ago to convert some assets in the Soviet Union from, essentially it was nuclear related activity to a peaceful enterprise. And after working on that project, I'll tell you what, it's not as easy as you think. And it's going to, if we go down this path, you're not talking about a few hundred million. You're talking $3-5 trillion bucks to get the job done, get the mess cleaned up, and get everybody converted over to something useful. And I'll tell you, in the meantime, you're going to have those Minuteman missiles ready, have them spun up, and ready to go on a moment's notice. That's just been my experience. And so I think it's naive to think that it's not going to be monumentally expensive. And it's going to take decades. And, and one of the first things we have to do is wait for some form of rule of law to go through in Russia before you can complete deals like this. And I was just wondering, it's just so, my impression is it's not possible to do it now.
Hmm. Well, Ambassador Gray, what do you think?
I think it is possible to do it. It's certainly going to be a lengthy process. I wouldn't say trillions, but it's going to cost billions. That is something we have to engage in. I think there's no more useful thing we could be doing right now to eliminate a real threat than working harder and funding fully these kinds of projects. There are other aspects to it. I mean, we actually have tried to find jobs for the Russian guys who were going to lose their jobs designing weapons. In terms of full alert and all of that stuff, I really think we could do a lot more to de-alert our systems and the Russian systems. We still got thousands of missiles pointed at us and vice versa. That can be launched at a moment's notice. We had a year or so ago, we had a sounding rocket go up off of Norway that was just doing a scientific experiment, and that it triggered an alert in Moscow. And fortunately, they cooled it and didn't fire. But the possibility for tragedy is always there. And I think to move some of this stuff to a de-alerted status where we're talking about hours rather than minutes or seconds is a damn good thing to do, and I think it's something we should actively explore with the Russians, because if we screw it up or if they screw it up, we're toast, and we're still at a hair-trigger alert, and it doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah,
people might disagree.
Yeah, I'll tell you what, from our experience, it was an eye-opener, and it's monumental. It's going to take decades. Now, I don't think that we should stop, but I'll tell you what, we have to be realistic. It's going to cost trillions. Hey, I'm glad I got to talk to you. I just wanted to tell you that's been our experience working in this area.
Okay. Well, I thank
Appreciate
you for
it.
The call. Let's go to someone else here in Urbana, line number two. Hello.
Yeah, good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I have been reading some, I think it was Brzezinski in one of his recent books. He was talking about the Warren Christopher Doctrine. And if I understood it right, it was basically kind of a hands-off.
Caller, I'm sorry. We're having a very difficult time hearing you.
I'm sorry. Okay, I'll try talking directly into the phone.
That's better.
I had read something by Warren Christopher. By Zbigniew Brzezinski, and he had been talking about the Christopher Doctrine. I guess referring to Warren Christopher, former Secretary of State, talking about sort of a hands-off policy to Russian adventurism, for example, in the Northern Caucasus. And the reason for this being that, we needed to maintain a good relationship with Russia so that we could work with them on getting rid of the their nuclear weapons. And I'm wondering if you could elaborate a little bit on what the Christopher Doctrine was and perhaps still is, if that's still the approach that we're following.
This is the first time I've heard of the Christopher Doctrine, the way you put it. As far as I'm concerned, yes, nuclear weapons are important. Yes, we should try to eliminate them. Yes, we need to work cooperatively with the Russians, but not at the expense of letting the Russians run wild in the Caucasus or elsewhere. To me, that's totally unacceptable. That doesn't increase our security. If we allow them to push people around, other people will push other people around, and we're right back to the rule of jungle. And that is unacceptable to me. I don't believe that makes any sense at all. That's just not in the cards, as far as I'm concerned. Human rights are human rights. Civil societies are civil societies. The rule of law is important, and we cannot and never should acquiesce in anyone not playing by the rules of the game.
Well, again, other people who are listening, if you have questions, you're certainly welcome to call 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. As we discussed at the beginning of the program, part of the deal of the NPT for those states that don't have weapons and they sign on promising not to develop them, there is also for them the promise that they would be allowed to use nuclear power for peaceful purposes. That is, you know, they should be allowed to have nuclear plants to generate electricity. You said, however, one of the problems here, though, is that it is possible for such a state who would be a signatory to the treaty to make it appear as if that is what they were doing and yet have a nuclear program and perhaps very quickly gear it up to the point where you can go from the peaceful use of nuclear technology to making bombs. And we do, I suppose, have the case in point is North Korea, that was indeed until 2003 a signatory to the non-proliferation treaty. What can be done in those cases to, again, make sure that the states, if they're interested in using nuclear power, can do that, and yet that we make sure that they don't take the whatever additional steps it takes to then go from that point to producing nuclear weapons?
Well, there are a couple of things you can do. One is to control the reprocessing technology but the most interesting thing is the International Atomic Energy Agency has come up with what they call additional protocols that tighten the inspection regimes when the inspectors come and visit these plants, so that they can keep very careful, more precise track of what's going on and what isn't going on. And if that's effectively implemented, it goes a long, long way to eliminate that risk. It gives you sort of an early warning system if someone's not playing according to the rules. So there are ways you can strengthen the inspection regimes. There are ways you can clamp down on the export of highly sensitive technology, which could lead toward nuclear weapons. These are the two ways to tackle it. And frankly, only through the Non-Proliferation Treaty can you really address this issue. It's not something you can do unilaterally or with a club of people. You can't do it on your own or with a small group of other nations. You need the cooperation of the entire international community. You need an inspection regime. I think the IAEA proved conclusively in Iraq that they knew more about what was going on in the weapons of mass destruction. There were none when we went into that war, because they took it all out. The inspectors that went in there eliminated. They did more to reduce the capability in Iraq for weapons of mass destruction than the whole Gulf War did. They really took away decades of stuff. And at the end, there was nothing there.
Three of the nuclear weapon states of today, India, Pakistan, and Israel, are not signers of the NPT.
That's correct.
What can you do about countries like that who were interested and apparently intent on developing nuclear weapons? Well, in the case of Israel, certainly they have some significant nuclear arsenal, and I guess we're not really quite sure about India and Pakistan. What can you do about those countries that don't sign on to the treaty, haven't signed on?
Well, I think there's a couple of things you can do. The first thing is that to the extent that the rest of the international community continues to adhere to this treaty, to the extent that the United States and the Russians are seen to be building down, in other words, eliminating their stuff, it imposes, it seems to me, logically, a similar inhibition to develop new systems or to begin to build more weapons both in India and Pakistan and in Israel. So that's one element. The other thing, of course, is that to the extent that the Pakistanis have nuclear weapons because the Indians have nuclear weapons, to the extent that their relationship improves, maybe the progress can be made in halting the numbers and the technologies and holding it at a present level and beginning to build down. In Israel, I think the key to it all, obviously, is a permanent solution to the vexing problems of the Middle East, which is more than a handful, but still, I mean, that's the only way we're going to be able to dull that cat. Hmm.
Let's take another caller. We have someone in Urbana on line one. Hello.
Yeah, hi. I'm not sure how scrupulously you want to, avoid getting into the political side of the whole thing, but I'm interested in that episode, however many years ago that was, where North Korea was allowed to pretty much, without interference, to remove a bunch of fuel rods that were under, that were being monitored by UN inspectors, and we pretty much just let them walk away with them. Somewhere around the build-up to the Iraq War. And I wondered how much do you think that was, kind of a blatant, political, just allowing them to, become the next nuclear threat.
Well, the exact sequence escapes me now, but I think they pulled them before they told anyone about it. They would disappear before the inspectors knew, were there. It wasn't like they were in place. They just threw the inspectors out and did it quickly. But the political decision was a tough one, and it's one that had to be made collectively. It's not something any administration or the United States alone has the unique say in. Trying to solve non-compliance by North Korea without engaging the Russians and the Chinese and the South Koreans is risky at best. What you're doing is, a conflict that breaks out with North Korea could cost as many as 1 million lives in South Korea in a matter of, hours. If you take a look at the tinderbox of that place is and how close Seoul is to the demarcation zone, if you start to take military action in that kind of a situation, you risk a conflagration, and you'll have to ask yourself, is that the right time, the right place, and the right war? And I think anyone that is faced with those kind of decisions has to react very cautiously. And I don't think the decision would have been much different, regardless of what administration was in power here. And I think at the time of the Iraqi the invasion of Kuwait, it was, of course, the Bush administration, the first Bush administration. But I don't think it's partisan. When you look at stuff that's as tricky as a decision on going to war, I think it's a sobering responsibility for whoever does it, particularly when you're dealing with a regime as obviously wacky as North Korea.
Okay, I guess my impression was that the Bush administration was rattling its saber, over nuclear weapons in Iraq at the same time that Kim Jong Il was just walking away with all this plutonium right under the inspectors' noses.
Well, I think the sequencing is probably wrong. That I don't think the timing was exactly like that. I believe that most of the shenanigans the North Koreans was up to was taking place in the Bush 1 and Clinton administrations. It wasn't synonymous with the decision to invade Iraq, which took place later. So I think there's a time warp there. Maybe several years earlier, the North Koreans started their shenanigans, and it wasn't directly related to the decision to go into Iraq, which took place subsequently.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot for your answer then.
All right. Thanks for the call. Again, somebody else wants to call real quick here. We might get them in before we find ourselves out of time. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. We mentioned that, I mentioned a couple of points certainly at the beginning of the program, that right at the moment, all this month, there was discussion of the treaty at the United Nations, and that this is part of a regular review that is scheduled to happen every 5 years. Is there anything specific that you would like to see come out of this particular review of the treaty?
Yes, what I'd like to see, ideally, is a final statement or communique in which is balanced in the sense that the five reaffirm their commitment to the ultimate elimination of nuclear weapons, and the others agree to strengthen the treaty's non-proliferation arrangements. That would be great. That having been said, I don't think that's likely. I think there'll be a stalemate because our reluctance to recommit, and along with the other four, and the reluctance of the others to commit to tightened inspection regimes and that sort of thing, absent some progress on the Article 4 is the nuclear power stuff. Article 6 is the commitment to the ultimate elimination. If you don't have a balanced reference to both of them, you don't have an agreement. And I think that's what's likely to happen. Now, this has happened in the past. We've had stalemates without final communiques a couple of times in the past. It's not the death knell of the treaty by any matter of means, but it makes it all the harder to get the kind of non-proliferation stuff built into that treaty, which we desperately need. We're going to squander about 2 or 3 years of time if we don't get agreement at this. You know, we'll pursue it and continue to push it, but. I think, you know, if to get a specific immediate commitment from the non-nuclear states in return for a future promise to eliminate nuclear weapons sounds like a heck of a good deal to me. It did in 2000. It still does in 2005. And I hope hopefully that's going to happen, but I'm not optimistic.
Could you I made reference to the fact that back in 2000 there was this agreement to take 13 practical steps toward disarmament, and that was the idea was to try to move beyond a more vague kind of commitment to do the same thing that had been happened in 1995. I wouldn't expect you to enumerate all 13, but what are some of the things that go into this?
Well, for example, a commitment to negotiate a fissile material cutoff treaty. A commitment for everyone to sign the total test ban treaty, the nuclear test ban treaty. Mm-hmm. A commitment on the part of the nuclear weapon states to agree to the ultimate elimination of nuclear weapons. Those are the most significant elements of it. In other words, a reaffirmation of progress on both counts. I think what's happened subsequently is with the North Korean episode and what's happening in Iran, everyone perceives the need to tighten up the transfer for nuclear power and that kind of technology. But to get that, we're going to have to reaffirm equally on our side our commitment to the ultimate elimination of nuclear weapons. There's a whole number of little things in there, but those are the ones that stand out to me, and I negotiated it. I still can't rattle it from heart, but those 13 steps that makes the most sense to me.
Mm-hmm. Of those countries that have nuclear weapons and also signed the treaty, the United States has far more than anybody else.
Well, I think the Russians probably have more than us, if you count all the tactical weapons they have. They have an enormous stock of those. But we're talking in the several thousands, probably, in both the Russian and American inventories.
I was wondering if you set aside the United States and Russia, and you look at those other countries, France, Britain, and China, we're not talking about the numbers that we're talking about with Russia and the United States. And as we have said, the United States, I think, has certainly come in for some criticism for not having a greater commitment to disarmament. How are they doing in France, Britain, and China? Are they indeed making any moves toward getting rid of or reducing the number of weapons that they have?
They have changed their force structures significantly. The French used to have missiles in the Albion Heights. They had to land-based systems, and they're gone now. They're both the French and the British have gone to sea with their systems, and you're talking about hundreds of weapons on both sides. The Chinese are modernizing their systems and have been in increasing their rocket capabilities, their launch capabilities over the last decade or so, but the numbers haven't significantly increased, the numbers of weapons. That's my best guess.
Mm-hmm. Well, at that, I think that we'll have to finish. If people, by the way, are interested in finding out more about the Global Security Institute, and if you have access to the Internet, the Institute does indeed have a website, so you can go there and you can find all about it, what it's all about, and specifically you can look at the activities of the Bipartisan Security Group, and that is the group that our guest, Ambassador Robert Gray, directs. So you can find out more information about the Institute and their interests. And to you, Ambassador Gray, I want to say thank you very much for giving us some of your time today.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Our guest, Ambassador Robert Gray, he is director of the Bipartisan Security Group at the Global Security Institute. It was founded by Senator Alan Cranston. The major focus of the Institute is nuclear disarmament. Programming here on WILL is made possible in part by Strawberry Fields on West Springfield Avenue in downtown Urbana. Strawberry Fields provides a wide assortment of natural foods, vitamins, bulk herbs, fresh breads, and produce. The Strawberry Fields Cafe, looking out on Springfield Avenue, features expanded seating for the deli and the coffee bar. The program today also made possible by support from Victorian House at 408 East Main in downtown Mahomet. Victorian House specializes in unique glass art, jewelry, and gifts. Victorian House also offers classes in bead making and stained glass. They have a website, which is victorianhouse.biz.